Hi, this is James White from the Solution Series, and I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Corey Lynn, and we're sponsored by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. Corey, great to see you today.
Good to see you too, my friend.
Yes, and this is another exciting Solution Series, and we have a great guest today. Folks, hang on, because our guest has got a wealth of knowledge, and he's going to be laying out a whole bunch of it here for us all, and let me give him a proper introduction. Joining us today is Stefan Verstappen. He's a Canadian author, researcher, and adventurer. He has written dozens of articles for various magazines and newspapers, and is the author of 8 books, including The Way of the Warrior, The 36 Strategies of Ancient China, pardon me, and The Art of Urban Survival. He has worked as an instructor for St. John Ambulance, a wilderness guide, a community organizer, and a martial arts instructor with over 35 years experience in the martial arts, including 5 years spent studying in China. He's the creator of viral YouTube documentary Defense Against the Psychopath, the Paradise Stolen series, and over 200 other videos. Stefan has been interviewed more than 200 times on radio, TV, and podcasts, including Coast to Coast, AM, John B. Wells, Caravan to Midnight, Jeff Rentz, Bill Martinez, Veritas Radio, SGT Report, and The Common Sense Show. Stefan Verstappen, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Solution Series. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me on, James and Corey.
It's great to see you again. Just so everyone knows, one of the things Stefan also does is personal consults to help people get situated with everything that we're going through as far as being prepared and coming up with plans for their family and what to prep for and whatnot. So we thought, my gosh, he's such a wealth of knowledge and has so much information and a full library on his website that everyone needs to check out, that we're trying to narrow it down to some like really good questions and answers, because there's just way too much to try and squeeze into an hour. So I wanted to start out with food. What you think is the best foods to store long term, and what are the best ways to prepare it? Or if you can't prepare it, do you option for MREs? And so we'll start with that, and we have a couple follow-ups on the food as well.
Sure. So personally, I can't speak about MREs. I've never eaten them, so I wouldn't know. From what I've heard, they're not very tasty, and they're not really very nutritious. But I don't see why you would need MREs. The only reason you would, you know, choose MREs is because they're lighter and they're easier to carry. So if you're going to be bugging out and you wanted to put food in your backpack and it not weigh you down, then the MREs might be a good solution for that.
Right.
But you don't need to do anything special. You need to just stockpile what you normally would stockpile. Now, what I tend to do is I divide my food into what I call staples and starches and proteins and grease. So staples and starches are things like pasta, flour, rice, powdered milk, and that's about it. The pasta and the flour and the rice, provided you put them in, you know, a sealed container of some kind, they will last, you know, 10-15 years. And what I've done is I've taken, you know, I've bought like 100 pounds of rice. Now, a lot of the preppers recommend that you put them into a big bucket. So you get a big plastic bucket and you put about 25 pounds of rice in each one of those buckets. And then you throw in some oxygen absorbers. And then you seal the bucket with comes with the plastic lid. That's fine if, you know, you got a big family and you're just prepping for your family. But my problem with that is, I'm one person. And so I'm not going to open up a 25 pound bucket of rice just to take out 2 cups of rice for a meal.
Right.
So what I have done is I've taken my rice, my 100 pounds of rice, and I've repackaged it. I put them into 2 pound Mylar bags. And then I put the oxygen absorbers in there and sealed it up with an iron. And those Mylar bags, the rice in the Mylar bags, keep 10-15 years. And that way I only need to take out as much as I plan to use. The 2 pounds will last me a week. So I only need to take out a week at a time. And then I won't be letting all the rest of the rice spoil every time I open up a big bucket.
Right. And that makes sense.
Other, Yeah, and the other advantage to this is because, well, I'm only looking after myself here where I am, but I'm also part of a larger community, and there's about 40 people, 10 families, and then we are all working together to support each other, to grow food. And we have things like a medical team, we have a communications team, we have a security team. And so, you know, we are going to be able to provide for ourselves what society used to be able to provide for us. And so the other thing is, with me dividing up my food stores into these 2-pound bags of rice, is that I can barter that rice, and I can also share that with my community. So I have a family that's just, you know, 5 minutes down the road from here, and if they should run short, it will be no problem for me to take 5 bags over, bring them over 10 pounds of rice. That'll last them a couple of months, and then we'll see what happens after that. So that's what I'm doing. I've done the same thing with flour. Flour is a great thing to store long term. The only trick you need to know about flour is that you should, before you put it into the Mylar bags, or if you want and to put it into these big buckets, that's up to you, but freeze the flour for 3 days minimum. I put it in the freezer for a week. And the reason for that is, by freezing the flour, you kill off all the tiny larvae that you cannot see in the flour. Mm-hmm. But after a year or two, those larvae will hatch into small tiny worms, and you'll see these little bugs in your flour. Now, you can eat those bugs, there's nothing wrong with it, but when you see these little bugs all through your flour, it's gonna,
yeah, just ask Klaus Schwab, he'll tell you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Eat the bugs, so, and you'll be happy.
Well, let me ask you this. So now what happens if, let's say, now it sounds like you have a wonderful community there, and it would be great if we could all do that, but some people, you know, aren't fortunate to have built up a system quite like that just yet. And so what happens if, as far as, you know, protecting your food items, if you do want to share, what's a good approach at sharing that food so that you're not alerting everyone that you have this huge stockpile of food sitting in your house?
Well, what I would do is, and I've said this a few times before when I talk about the subject, because it comes up a lot of times, you know, people say, well, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I tried to warn people, they didn't prepare. And so if they're starving, well, too bad for them. I'm not going to help them.
That's terrible.
Well, a lot of people have that attitude.
I know.
And well, that's not me. First of all,
right.
You know, people are people, and just because they didn't follow the advice doesn't mean they deserve a slow, painful death, all right?
Right.
And not only that, a lot of these people, especially where I live here, they have families. You know, there's little kids, for crying out loud. So what, I'm just going to sit here and eat and watch little kids starve to death? I can't do that. And right. If I have to starve along with them, I'd rather starve with them than sit here with a full belly and just simply sit back and watch other people starve. So what I would do is I would find a way. Now, you got to get to know your neighbors, and you got to know the people within your area. But what I would do is I would cook up some pots of food, and I would just simply hand deliver them to the people that I know are suffering. And the other alternative would be to, you know, for example, set up a table down in the lobby. If you're in an apartment building, go down to the lobby. Or if you're, you know, living on a street in a subdivision, then maybe you could set up a table in the local park and bring some food down there. And if people ask, you say, well, it was a food bank that donated this food for us. I'm a member of the food bank, and so I brought this food back for you. So that way you're not directly linking yourself to the source of the food, but and still you still have a chance to share with others. Now, one thing I think people should learn is what I call famine cooking. And I learned this concept when I was living in China, because the Chinese have gone through numerous famines. Their whole history is littered with famine, and that is why to this day the Chinese will eat anything, everything, you know, mm-hmm. bats and chicken feet, and they'll eat anything because they've been through famines. So what I call famine foods, for example, for me, I've got pasta, rotini, and I package them, same thing like I did with the rice and with the flour, into 2-pound bags. Now, a 2-pound bag of rotini will make me like a big bowl of pasta this big, right? Then I've got cans of tomato sauce. I got cans with meatballs in it. I've got cans of mushrooms, so I can fry up the mushrooms. So if I were to, you know, put all that stuff, I'm going to have a giant bowl. I can feed 8 people, and maybe I double that. Maybe I can feed 16 people. So now I'm going to use 4 pounds of rotini and a couple of cans of everything, and I make this big bowl, and I do that once every other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I package it in the Tupperware container, and I either hand deliver it to the families that have children so that the kids can eat, okay?
Right.
Or if I'm in, you know, because get to know your neighbors, folks, you know, like you'll be able to see it. And if not, then bring it out to, like I said, set up a little table, you know, at the local park.
I like the idea of the table, because that could be something that a community could actually do, like once a week, where you set something up somewhere and everyone can bring in items that they have and kind of do a swap, you know?
You could do that. And like I said, with the community that I belong to, and we do our own gardening, and they harvest lots of vegetables. We've had some really good harvests this year. And I know they agree with me on donating 10% to the local community. So now if I make up 2 big bowls of pasta, and or the other thing is stew is always really good.
Mm-hmm.
Soup, right? You can make a huge bowl of soup. You can make, you know, 5-gallon tub of soup. Excuse me. Out of hardly, you know, any ingredients, and at least that'll put a hot meal in everybody's belly. Now, you right. might not be able to do that every day, but again, people, we can go a long time without food. I recommend people learn how to sporadically fast. I do it once a month for 2-3 days. And it's really not a big deal. After 2 days, you don't feel hungry anyways. You will not starve to death very quickly. And so the food is more of a morale booster, so that, you know that every Friday night I'm going to go out and I'm going to make a 5-gallon pot of soup, and whoever comes down the street to the table, and then, you know, we have maybe some vegetables donated by the rest of the community, then everybody gets a big meal once a week. And listen, if that's all I can do, then that's all I can do.
Stefan, that brings up another, center up, that brings up the next point. Now, food, we can go without food for quite a period of time. Not so much with water. We have to have water. I don't know how many days, 3-4 days without water, you're going to be in trouble. Any longer than that, you probably, you know, would be worse off. The question is, I mean, how much water do you have stored at home at any given time for these situations? Now, if there's a situation where the toilet doesn't flush and you have to pour water in the toilet to get it to flush, I would suggest you use another method. But that aside, the flushing and the, you know, how about just for cooking and drinking? How much water should you have aside? And then how should you treat it? You've heard different ways. Iodine, you can put a little capful of bleach in there. You know, water filtration systems. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. So water is going to be a big problem if the grid goes down or if the power goes out. People overlook the water situation. Water is crucial. Yeah, you can go 3 days without water, but on the third day, you have such a splitting headache, you can barely function. So it will take you probably a week to die. But the last 4 days, you can't function. You're going to be delirious. So people often overlook how much water you need. You need a lot of water. Now, the minimum amount of water you require is 1 gallon per person per day. And the way that's divided up is you're going to need 1/2 gallon of water for drinking water. All right. Then you need 1/4 gallon of water to cook with. So if I'm going to make soup, listen, I'm going to need a lot more than 1/4 gallon of water, right? But even just for simple meals, You know, even like ramen noodles, you're going to need quarter gallon of water per day. And that leaves you a quarter gallon of water for sanitation. Now, obviously, you're not going to take a bath or a shower. This is a sponge bath, right? You just get a face cloth, you soak it in hot water and soap, and you wash yourself down, and then you rinse that cloth out, and you you do the same thing again, and that's your rinse. So 1 gallon per person per day, that's a lot of water to store. And I recommend people have at least 1 week's worth of water stored ahead of time, because there's a lag between now the water is suddenly cut off and now you have to find water. It's going to take you a couple of days because you got to find it, you got to transport it, and then you got to disinfect it and purify it. So that's a lot of time, a lot of effort. And God forbid you should live in a high-rise building and the power goes out and you got to walk 20 flights of stairs to get back to your apartment. And you got to walk 20 flights of stairs carrying 5 gallons of water every day for your family. You're going to be exhausted. And then you have to still purify that water. So it's better that you have at least a week's supply worth of water in your house. Now, what I do is I've got those 5 gallon containers. They're clear plastic water containers. They have a little spout. They're usually square. So I filled them up, 5 gallons each one, and I've got 5 of them in underneath the sink. Okay, that's where I store my water, underneath the sink. What I've done is I filled it up with the tap water. I added 2 drops of chlorine just so that it will prevent any bacteria from growing anyways. And then I keep that under the sink. So 25 gallons. Oh, listen, I'm good for more. I'm good for 2 weeks. So I don't have to worry right away about where I'm going to get the water. But depending on where you live, getting water is going to be a big problem. Now, typically what happens is, you know, in the city, the water is stored up in the water towers. If you're in a small town, everybody knows the big water tower with the name of the town on it. If you live in a high-rise building, the water is stored in tanks on the roof. And so when the power goes out, you'll still be able to get water from the tap, and you still be able to get water to flush the toilet. But I wouldn't flush the toilet. You want to preserve the drinking water as long as you can. And so that might last a day, 2-3 days, all right? But still, you're better off to have this water stored underneath the sink, whatever you can put it in.
What about a filtration system? If you were to live near a river and you could go get it from the water, what filtration method do you recommend?
Okay, well, there's different ways of purifying water, okay? One way is chlorine. If you add about 8 drops of chlorine bleach, all right, just household bleach, for every gallon of water, and then you let it stand for at least 30 minutes. Usually what we do is we swish it around, right, to get the chlorine throughout the water. That should take care of most of the pathogens and the parasites. So that's an easy way to disinfect it. So stockpile some chlorine. You're going to need chlorine bleach for a number of other things as well, especially when we get to waste disposal. You want to keep the place clean. And you want to be able to disinfect things. So 8 drops of water, or 2 drops for every quart of water. So if you want to keep it in water bottles, empty water bottles, fill them up with tap water, or fill them up with water that you can scavenge from the local creek or the local lake, then 2 drops of water should do it. You can also get the carbon filtration systems. These are the water filters that a lot of people have in their houses. And some are reverse osmosis, and they're very expensive. And even the carbon filtration filters are pretty expensive. And what that does is it filters the water through these cylinders that are made up of carbon. And that, again, takes out most of the harmful bacteria and parasites and viruses. So if you have that in the house, that's great, but probably your water line is already, you know, hooked up to it anyways. So you'd have to take that apart and figure out another way of getting water through there. Or you can buy like a standalone unit, like a Berkey water filter, and then you can just pour in the water that you scavenge from the creek or the lake, and that'll do a pretty good job. The only trouble with the carbon filtration systems and the reverse osmosis systems is two problems. One, they're expensive. You know, it costs a lot of money for this stuff. And two, these filters eventually wear out. Now, depending on what kind of system you buy, the filter can last for like a year, but also depends on what kind of water you're filtering. If the water you're getting is really dirty to begin with, say it's just a small creek and the water comes back and it's kind of brownish, so you can tell that it's really dirty, then you're going to use up those filters a lot more quickly, and they'll be no good after, you know, 3-4 months. So not the best, but there is no best way to do this. Okay.
Now, what about for waste, for sanitation purposes? If you can no longer flush the toilet and you don't have running water in the house, what do you recommend for sanitation purposes?
Okay, we're going through these questions really fast. You want me to go through all the questions?
That's because we only have 1 hour. So much information.
Okay, so, well, to dispose of human waste is really going to be a big problem. You know, if you live in a big city now, I used to live in Toronto here, and the downtown section have, you know, hundreds now of high-rise condominiums, you know, 20, 30, 40 stories tall. If you happen to live in the downtown section in one of these condominiums, then be prepared to bug out, because you won't survive in these condominiums. First of all, there's nowhere to get water in downtown, and there's no way to dispose of human waste. If you're out in the suburbs, one thing you could do is, well, first of all, let's go back. If the plumbing is still working, but you don't have water, then you can still probably use your toilet, except you have to flush about a half a gallon of water down to get it to flush. So, okay, so that can still work for a while. Of course, you're going to still have to carry all this water back to your place, not only for eating and drinking and making food, but also to flush the toilet. So you got a lot of water to carry. And but if that is working, then okay. Now, the last place I lived was on a septic system and it backed up, so you couldn't flush the toilet anyways, no matter what. And where are you going to dispose of the waste product, the sewage? Well, if you have enough room, let's say you're out in the suburbs and you got a big backyard, then one way to do it is what they call you dig a cat hole, which is like an 8-inch deep hole in the backyard. Keep it as far away from the house as possible. Keep it as far away from any creeks or rivers that might be running through your property. The more isolated, the better. And then, yeah, you can bury your feces in these little cat holes. This won't last too long if it goes on, because one little cat hole will last you a day, right? So if it's a month or 2 months, now you got 60 little holes in your backyard filled with feces that isn't going anywhere. So don't go for a walk in the backyard, because you're going to be sinking into this really nasty mess, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I would say, what I had to do was, you get some garbage bags and get the heavy duty garbage bags, stockpile garbage bags. You're going to need a lot of garbage bags. And what you can do is you can, you know, get rid of the water that's in the toilet bowl, and you can get rid of the water that's in the tank. And the water that's in the tank you can drink, so that's okay. But not, obviously not the water that's still in the toilet bowl. So you empty that out, and then you just take one of these heavy-duty garbage bags, and you wrap it around the rim of the toilet, and then drop the seat down over top of it, and you can do your business there. I've had to do that for about a week. I got to tell you, it's really unpleasant emptying out these garbage bags.
I bet.
What about just like a 5-gallon bucket with a, you can go buy a cheap toilet seat lid or something like that at the hardware store, and pick up, you know, an empty 5-gallon, you know, one of the big paint buckets, the big 5-gallon buckets. You could probably pull something like that off. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. You can do that. Now they sell them too. They're called for camping. They sell them for camping, and it's the 5-gallon bucket with a lid, and it comes with a toilet seat on it. So you can do that too. trouble is you got to be dragging this 5-gallon bucket of feces to wherever you're going to dump it. So we pass about 2 pounds worth of feces every day. So if you've got, you know, 5 people in your family, 2 days, you got to empty that bucket out every 2 days, right? And that's a big bucket. And where are you going to empty it? You shouldn't dump it in the local creek, because now you're going to be contaminating the water for everybody up and down that creek. And then, you know, it won't pour into an 8-inch little hole somewhere. So you're going to have to dig like a really deep hole. If you still have garbage pickup, you know, if you know, they got garbage bins and they're coming, then I would bag it again in the heavy duty garbage bags. And if they're picking it up, then put it in the garbage bag, in the trash, and let them pick it up. But chances are, if it's really shit hits the fan, then you know, you're not going to get garbage pickup either. So all these bins will fill up very quickly with all your neighbors and everyone else contributing to them. And then it's going to sit there and stink for the rest of the year. So it's a short-term fix, you know, to get the 5-gallon drum, but where are you going to pour this stuff? Now, if you live, say, next to a large wooded area, or a forest, or a national forest, or a park, well, then you can go and you can dig a deeper hole, and then you can empty the contents of that 5-gallon pail into there. And again, so long as it's as far away as possible from any water sources or people's gardens and homes and that, because you don't want to contaminate everyone else, because then you will get contaminated too. Again, untreated sewage is the cause for typhoid and cholera and dysentery. And you can get it from the other people. You know, you give it to them and then they give it back to you. So it's very important that you have a proper method of disposing of this waste. The best method I can think of that I have come up with is a composting toilet. Now, a composting toilet is what they often use in RVs. And what it is it's a toilet. It's plastic. It's got the seat and everything. And it has 2 tanks. One tank is for urine. And so when you go to the bathroom, and guys, we have to sit down when you use it because you can't stand up. So if we're going to take a wee, then we have to sit down, and then you flip a switch on or a lever on the side of the toilet, and your urine will go into one tank. And then if you have to defecate, you switch the lever again, and then the feces goes into another tank. Now, in that tank is lined with kind of a dry material. Most typically, it's coconut husks. And it's dried out, and it comes in bricks that you can break apart with your hand. And you throw that into that second tank. They also can use things like ground up cedar chips, and you can put that in there. And then there's a little handle on the side of the toilet. And after you've done your number 2, you crank this handle, and then there's a couple of blades, and that, you know, mixes the feces with the composting material, the coconut shell husks or the cedar chips. And what happens is it gets rid of the smell. It's quite amazing that it really doesn't stink that much. And it helps to break down the feces, okay? And a compost toilet will last 2 people. This is what I've heard. And again, it depends on the type of unit you buy, but it can last you up to a month for 2 people. The urine you're going to have to probably pour out a lot sooner, but for the feces, it's probably good for about a month. And then when you do empty it out, again, you need those heavy duty garbage bags, then everything comes apart. The lid comes off the toilet, and then the 2 containers come out. One is the urine container, and the other is the feces container. But the feces container is mixed with, like I said, this dried material that soaks it up and helps to decompose it. And it doesn't smell bad. And then you can, you know, flip over the container, put it into a heavy duty garbage bag, and then take that out to the countryside somewhere. And it's a lot easier to dispose of because it's not like pure feces. It's already partly decomposed. Yeah,
I'd never heard of those toilets before. That's fascinating. I'm definitely going to look into those. That's great, a great tip. But I want to swing you back if I can for a minute, because I'm up here in Montana and it gets pretty cold in the winter. Really cold, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And you know, not everybody has a wood burning stove. And you know, if there was a situation where the electricity went out, a lot of people are using electric heat still. What type of options do you have in that situation where you live in a colder environment? And I would say probably in a cold environment, maybe what, 30% of the people maybe have wood burning stoves. Maybe that's a little bit of a high estimate, but a lot of folks don't. A lot of folks rely on heat, you know, electric heat. What's your options in a cold weather climate like that, Stefan, to make yourself, you know, because you can die of hypothermia if you don't keep yourself warm. So it's important. It's important to know that. Over to you.
Look what happened in England a couple of years ago. It was really cold, and I forget what the numbers were, 500, 1,000 people, and mostly seniors too. They froze to death in their homes because they couldn't afford the heating oil. Now, if you want to switch over to heating oil, that will give you some more options. So you've got like a 200-gallon tank on the side of your house. You fill it up once a year, and then that will provide heating oil for an oil heater, and then you can heat your house that way. So that is an alternative to the wood-burning stove. Wood-burning stove sounds great. I've had them before in the past. They are a big pain in the butt because, you know, if you have a small wood burner, wood stove, you got to feed wood into it every hour. You know, it's just, you don't get any sleep, right? Because as soon as you fall asleep, it goes out, and you wake up an hour later, you're freezing. So you have to start the fire again and start feeding the wood. If you have a big wood stove, that's great. You fill it up with wood. It gets really hot for 2 hours, too hot. And then after 3 hours, it burns out too. And then you're up again at 3 o'clock in the morning feeding wood into it. Plus, you need to supply or stockpile, cords of wood. It takes a lot of wood. You know, I've done a lot of camping, and I've had the wood stoves before. People think you put a log in there and you're good for the night. Oh my God, no. You got to burn through a lot of wood. So if you do have a wood stove at home, make sure you've got lots of wood stockpiled. And if you think you're going to go out into the forest and scavenge enough wood, good luck with that.
Stefan, let me interject for a second. I had a hunter training course when I was young, and they talked about if you got caught in the woods at night while you were hunting and you had to spend the night and you had to cut wood, they said lay down on the ground, measure how long you are, make marks on the ground, and then figure out how high you are. So you need a stack of wood. So find out a pile of wood that would be your length and your height, and then double it. That's what you're going to need to get through the whole night to make sure that you're secure. Do you have any comments on that specific that specific point?
I haven't heard that way of figuring it out, but yeah, that's about right. And, that, and again, you're looking at approximately a cord of wood or a quarter cord of wood. You just burn through wood like crazy. And again, it wouldn't be like hardwood that you've chopped from logs. It's, you know, the kind of scrap wood that you're picking up. And then, yeah, if you pile it as high as you are, yeah, that will last you the night. But you got to do that every day. And, if you're staying in one place, you're going to be circling wider and wider and wider through the forest to find enough wood to do that. Look at what happened in Bosnia. They had the same problem there. And within 3 months, people had torn out the flooring and the doors and the roofs and the ceilings of every house within 100 miles just to burn the wood because they were.
What are some good options for heating then? If the wood burning stove is a tricky one.
Well, wood burning stove is good. If you have one, great. Okay, use it. So first of all, I always like to do double redundancy or triple redundancy. Don't rely on one method for anything. Same thing with purifying your water. Like, don't rely on just a water filter. Use other things. You know, use iodine to purify water and chlorine bleach. And you can use ultraviolet and you can use distilling the water. So you know, I've got 3, 4, 5 different ways to purify water. And then the same thing with heating your home. If you got a wood stove, perfect. That's one way to heat your home. If you're on electric heat, then you definitely need to figure out two more alternatives. Now, I have two other alternatives. One is a kerosene heater. This one was pretty inexpensive. It was like $150. And, you know, I'm stockpiling kerosene for the winter, and it'll heat up, you know, a 10 by 20 foot room. All right. And it's fairly safe. And for example, it has an automatic switch that turns it off if you should tip this thing over so it won't set the house on fire. So that's another way of doing it.
I'm curious, how long does that burn? Like, how much kerosene is required to get you through a night?
Probably about a quart would be my estimate. And again, it depends on how high you set the settings and how big the unit is that you're using. What I would do for the winter time is I would move everybody into one bedroom. So say you have a family, 5 people, mom, dad, 3 kids. You're not going to heat up the whole house, not even with a wood-burning stove, okay? Wood-burning stove only heats up the room that it's in. It's not going to heat up the bedrooms upstairs. It's not going to heat up the kitchen down the hall. So for sleeping, you need the heat for when you're sleeping. If you're up and about, then, okay, you're going to wear double layers of clothes and you're staying physically active. So, okay, you're not going to freeze to death, but it's when you're going to bed. So I would get everybody in the bedroom or in the, let's say it's the living room or the den where you have the wood stove. Okay, great. Then go. Everybody goes in there. Set up cots on the floor or bring in the mattresses and lots of sleeping bags and blankets and, you know, get the wood stove burning and heat up the room. And then after that, just as the wood is starting to wear out, maybe turn on a kerosene heater. So you're dividing your resources, right? Get the wood stove to heat up the room quickly, go for a couple of hours. But when it's time to fill up the wood stove again at 3 o'clock in the morning, instead of going out in the back and chopping more wood, maybe just let it burn out. And now's the time to turn on the kerosene.
Stefan, can I make a point? If you're out and you just circle back to food for a minute, if you're out every day chopping wood and scavenging out in the forest, going through, you know, tromping through the woods, chopping wood, chopping down trees, I mean, you're going to use a lot of calories and a lot of energy. Yeah. You should make sure that you have extra food available because, again, you're going to be burning up a whole, I mean, chopping wood, go out and try it, folks. Go out and try chopping down a tree and chopping it up into smaller pieces. Forget about it. I mean, it's really, really taxing. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the more active you're going to be, the more food and the more water. Now, typically we say we need 3 liters of water for a woman per day and about 4 liters or 4 quarts of water per man per day. But what if you live in Arizona and it's 100 degrees out? You can easily double your water intake. And the same thing for heavy physical activity. Normally, I would say you need about, on average, 2,000 calories per day for moderate activity. But I remember I used to work in a railroad camp. It was a moving railroad camp, and we were out in the woods all the time. It was all chopping woods and digging and laying down the foundation for railroad tracks. Hard work. We did it all summer. It paid for our college tuition back in the days when college tuition was $1,200 a year. So you would go up there and you'd live there for 3 months, and it was hard work. But my God, the food they served you, unbelievable. It was like turkeys and hams and roast beef and potatoes.
Wow.
I mean, it was like, and so everybody that worked on that camp probably ate 3,500, 4,000 calories a day. But it's because it's backbreaking work, it's hard labor, and you need that kind of calories because you burned it up anyways. And so they knew that they had to feed their workers. I mean, you lived in a moving bunkhouse, but the food that they prepared every day, and that was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Breakfast, you know, turkey for breakfast, turkey for lunch, whatever you wanted. So you're going to have to take into account that you're going to double your calorie requirements. And yeah, James, you know what it's like. Yeah, go ahead, chop down wood. Go ahead, chop some wood. Or even something as simple as you want to build a, you want to dig a hole to dispose of your sewage.
Yeah. Dig a hole. Taxing. Digging's very, very taxing.
Digging is really taxing. I just buried my two cats. One
Aww,
last one.
I'm sorry.
Sorry to hear that.
Oh, yeah, they were my sweeties. So I gave them a Viking burial here in the woods behind where I live. But, Aww. You know, I dug a hole that was, you know, 2 feet square and 2 feet down. Oh, my God, that is hard work. And, of course, you're digging in the, you know, in the forest. You got rocks, tree roots and things like that. It's not like digging a hole on the beach or something like that. So, I mean, it is taxing work. And so that's the kind of hole you'd have to dig if you wanted to dig a latrine, right, or for an outhouse. It's a lot of work. So you're there, you're sweating. So you're going to double your caloric intake and you're going to double your water needs.
Okay. So, you know, if you're out there chopping wood and you're going through the woods and you're doing that activity, inevitably you're going to get injured. It's you're doing things that you're not used to doing. Like if there's a situation, I'm not used to going out in the woods and out chopping wood and hauling water and stuff like that. And probably most people watching this video don't do that ever, but they're going to have to. And if they do have to, there's going to be some injuries. What do you recommend? I mean, obviously a medical bag or a medical kit. How extensive do you need to go? I mean, do you need to go all the way down to where you have like an IV bag or an IV kit in case things get really serious? What books do you recommend? That type of thing.
Well, all the books that you would need are in my survival library. If you go to my website, you'll see a link, my survival library. I haven't raised the price on it yet, so it's still $50, but you get 300 books plus all my books. And there is about 15 books on emergency first aid and medicine, like how to scavenge medicinal plants in the forest, what to do, what you need to put into a medical kit, emergency surgical technique. It's all in there. You got to get that information because you can't, you know, first of all, everybody should take a decent first aid course, take a weekend course, you know, Saturday, Sunday. But then you need to supplement your knowledge. Here within the community that I have very good first aid skills because I used to teach it. But we also have like three women that they grow their own medicinal plants and they make their own tinctures and treatments like colloidal silver. They make their own colloidal silver and they know all kind of home remedy cures for when you get sick. So it's good to have people around you that have some skills. Now, I personally recommend that you put together a medical kit, not a first aid kit. First aid kit is okay, but, you know, you go to the pharmacy and you buy one of these first aid kits. It's got Band-Aids and some disinfectant. Okay, it's all right for small injuries, but really for long-term survival, you need a whole medical kit. So this is a first aid kit on steroids. So not just Band-Aids, but pressure dressings and not just some, you know, some disinfectant, but you need to have hydrogen peroxide and isopropyl alcohol and Dettol is another version. And you need a lot of it, a lot of it, right?
Iodine.
Iodine is great for a lot of things. I can't recommend iodine enough. Very good for infections, like, and for sterilizing. And again, for treating infections, you get a toothache, put some iodine on it. Trust me, it'll clear it right up. And speaking of toothache, oil of clove. I would put that in my medical kit.
Excellent. Excellent.
Because again, that's for toothaches, right? So you want to try to plan for everything. We're not going to have a dentist. We're not going to have a hospital. So you need to have as much in there as possible. The other thing that I put in my medical kit is antibiotics. I stockpile them. I order them online from a pet food store. All right. It's the same antibiotics. They make them for pets, for fish, for horses. It's the same quality as for humans. It's made in the same factory in China, and it's a tenth of the cost. So I stockpile antibiotics. Trust me, you're going to need it. Not even if it's just for yourself, but again, for your community. If the neighbor's kids come down with bronchial pneumonia, and there's no doctors around, they're going to die unless they get a solid treatment of antibiotics. And if you stockpile 200, 300, 400 capsules, you can easily treat 2 or 3 dozen people and save their lives. So again, you know, spreading your knowledge and trying to help other people, antibiotics is a good way to go. The other thing I recommend people do is, yes, an IV kit. And an IV kit and also an enema. Now, the reason for this is because some of the most common waterborne diseases like cholera and dysentery, it will kill you. But the way it kills you is it dehydrates you. You can die in four hours from dehydration. I knew guys that went to these, you know, extreme fitness camps, and they trained so hard and they sweat so hard, they had to be rushed to the hospital after 4 hours. They were that close to a heart attack because they had flushed all the water and moisture out of their system, but also the electrolytes. If you don't have the electrolytes, your body shuts down. Your heart
Brilliant. That's a brilliant point. Literally
stops. So if you have those kinds of diseases, and they will be rampant during a grid collapse kind of scenario where people don't know what to do with their feces and they can't get enough water. And so everybody's going to be sick around you. Okay. A lot of people are going to be dropping dead from this stuff, and you can treat them if you can get fluids into them. So an IV is good, but you do need to know how to insert an IV needle. Now, if you go on Amazon, you can buy an IV kit, and they also have a rubber arm training module that you can also buy. That's not very much, about $25, and it will teach you how to insert the needle. Or if you know a nurse, again, we have nurses in our community, so I don't have to worry about that. They know how to insert an IV. But if you don't know how to do that, you can get a kit and you can practice on a rubber arm so that you know what you're doing. But even easier than an IV, and from what I've heard, even though I find this unbelievable myself, but an enema is more effective in getting hydration into a person than even an IV. So you take an enema, you fill it up with water, you add a teaspoon of salt, so that'll bring in the electrolytes, and you insert it in the anus, and apparently the lower colon will absorb that water more readily than an IV. So now, your medical kit, you have a way to treat the most common kinds of diseases and the most common kinds of death, which is dehydration.
Not to mention the fact that when some people, when they're under that kind of illness, if they do ingest something through their mouth, they immediately dispel it back out again, and it even draws more moisture out of their body. So going through the other way, to be polite, is seemingly a much better way as far as that, to for sure, for people that have, you know, illnesses where they've been vomiting or that type of thing.
Yes, exactly, James. You hit the nail on the head with that, because that's the problem with these diseases, is that you can't keep anything down. So they're dehydrated. Here, drink this. They drink it and they throw it up right away. And whatever moisture they have in their stomach, they throw up with that as well. So you can't get them to hold down water or soup or anything. They're going to throw it up, and that's what causes the death and the dehydration. So if you use an enema, you can get them, you can rehydrate them. They're not going to throw it up. So that's why I would keep those items. They're cheap. They're not bulky or anything like that. And again, it's a medical kit, not a first aid kit. This is for long-term survival in your home, where you're going to have to deal with not only injuries, but different kinds of diseases. So that's why.
So should we have a suture kit too?
I do have a suture kit. Yeah, you can buy them online. I got two. One is kind of a cheapy made in China suture kit that I bought on Amazon. And the other is a surgical quality suture kit that my doctor friend gave to me, because he has access to really high quality, and it's all sealed in special plastic, and so it's sterile. So I have two suture kits, but again, you don't really need a suture kit for most types of injuries. You know, trying to sew up a large wound, there's other ways to take care of it. You've got butterfly bandages. It's like a Band-Aid. It looks like a butterfly. You stick one to one end of the wound, and you stick the other, and then you pinch, you know, you pinch the gap together, and it will hold it into place. The other thing you could do is you can buy a stapler on a surgical stapler on Amazon. And that's literally a stapler, and it'll insert staples instead of stitches.
And it feels just great. And it feels just great when you do that. By the way, I gotta say. Holy cow, staple that together.
I would actually prefer if I had a gash in my arm, and I would rather have someone just go bam, 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 bam with staples than sit there and wait for them to thread a needle through.
You know, I want to make a quick point. This is just a quick thing here. I didn't expect here, but this is an oral care kit, and you can pick it up. They're like $6 or $7. It comes with a little mirror in it, a little pick, and it's just a little oral care kit that I have that you should put in your bag, I would think, just because, you know, I mean, something gets caught in your tooth and you can't get it out and it gets lodged, it can get infected and it can cause, you know, greater illness if you don't get that taken care of. You, Stefan?
Also what Stefan reminded me of, which I've used in the past and I hadn't even thought of it till he brought it up, was the little kit you get where you can pack in your fillings. Because I had to use that once I was camping and I had to drive a half an hour away to get to a drugstore to get one of those little kits, and it works. It immediately stops the pain. It's like a little clay ball that you kind of wedge in.
Wow, never heard of that. Never heard of that.
Yeah, you can get it at Walgreens, CVS, yeah.
Yeah, it's called dental putty, and you can get it at the pharmacy. And there's two kinds. Well, there's actually one kind, and it comes in a little tiny a jar, and you just scoop some out, and you roll it into a little ball about the size of a small pea. And then if you have a cavity or you lost a filling or something like that, first of all, disinfect it, right? So rinse it out with hydrogen peroxide, and here's where the oil of clove comes in. Well, again, because if you have pain from that filling falling out, put some oil of clove in there, and then you put this little putty and you kind of pat it in there. It's just like it's got the same consistency as caulking, you know, when you're caulking around the bathtub, and you just push it in there. And if there's anything excess, you just wipe it off. It gets hard and it will stay in your tooth for a month easy. And it's like a temporary filling for a cavity. Now, what I do is I have my medical kit, but I also have a dental kit, which is what you just mentioned, James. It's got the pick, it's got the mirror, it's got dental floss. But in addition to that, I put in the dental putty and the oil of clove. And I also have another thing. These are little balls of plastic that when you heat it up to just close to boiling, not quite boiling, they turn clear and then they melt. And you can use this to make a bridge to hold a tooth. I had a tooth that was loose, and so I mixed this stuff up. And again, you put it into place. It's just hard enough where it's very soft. But once it cools down to the temperature of your mouth, it's hard as plastic. And so you can make a bridge from that. You can hold a tooth in place if it's loose and you still want to eat. There's a lot of uses for this plastic. So I put all that in my dental kit. So I've got my dental kit and my medical kit.
There's so many great tips that we could talk for 3 hours. So I want to encourage everyone to go to your library and get the books. I've downloaded them all. They're in PDF format. It's awesome. So if the internet ever goes down, you know, people could print these out into a binder. And you also do the consults and you also do the community building. So I would love to end this with some tips on and suggestions on building a community. And I know you've got a great one there. What are some suggestions for people in the networking and how to find or build a community?
Okay, so building a community is it's time intensive. It's very difficult to start from scratch. So what I'm recommending to people now is join an existing community. Now, it doesn't matter what that community is. You've got to meet people in your neighborhood. So if that means joining the Neighborhood Watch program or the Block Parent program or joining a service club like the Rotarians or the Lions Club, or certainly your local church. If you belong to the church, you have a ready-made community already there. So I would join in an existing community. Starting one from scratch at this point it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of work because people are really hesitant, and you can't go around saying, listen, you know, we're worried about, you know, the whole civilization collapsing. Do you want to work together? Well, you're going to turn a lot of people off. They don't want to hear that. They think you're conspiracy theorists. They don't want to know. So you're not going to get anybody signing up for that. So my recommendation is join a community, whatever it is, a homeschooling program. If you have kids, certainly you shouldn't send your kids to school anyways. So join a local homeschooling program. Now, when things get bad, this existing community will automatically start to help each other out more. And if you have the skills and knowledge to survive, if you follow what we've been talking about here on the program, and you know, you have some idea of how to survive all this and how to treat some minor illnesses and how to scavenge for food and water and purify things, now you become an authority in that area. People will automatically start to come to you for help when that happens, and you've got that community already. So again, the church, Alliance Club, homeschooling, block parents, join one of those existing communities already. I had a friend that he was in Chicago, no friends, no family, wanted to join a community. I said, I can't recommend any communities because I don't know anybody near you. And I told him, I said, whatever you do, get out of Chicago because you won't survive downtown Chicago. You're not going to survive this. So he rented the car. He started to drive through the countryside. He was up in North Carolina. He stayed overnight at a town. He noticed that they had a local AA, and that's what I told him. I said, well, go to the local Alcoholics Anonymous group, because he's been sober for 35 years, and he's still a member. So he went to the local Alcoholics Anonymous group. It turned out that they were a very tight-knit group. They had a businessman there that had built four cabins that he rented out at extremely low cost. And so they invited him to live in one of the cabins. He had a place to live. They got him a job, and they're looking after him. And then he started to tell them about, let's stockpile some food and let's get some first aid materials together. So he was able to influence that group. But he joined an existing group, and he automatically fit in. So that's what I would recommend, folks. Become a part of the community, whatever that may be. Train yourself. Get your skills together. Get as much prepared as you can with whatever money you have. And then as things deteriorate, you will be able to offer advice, and you will have the skills and the knowledge to lead that community. And because everybody then is in the same boat, everybody's looking for water, or everybody's hungry, or everybody's, you know, worried about illnesses, they will look towards you, and now you can mold that group and help them to survive, and they will help you to survive.
You know, I want to put a plug in. Corey, don't we have on our resource page, don't we have some of those groups that we have listed on our resource page about people that can join up with people in their community? Or am I speaking on
We do. People should check out the resource page. In the solution series here, we put together a pretty extensive list, and there are some good groups in there where you can go in and look, you know, for your city or your location, and find others as well. So yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. That's a great approach. I think that that might ease the mind of some people who don't really have, you know, are in an area where maybe they have a few friends, but it's more of a blue state, and they just don't have the ability to build that community. That's really a great way of looking at it. And so yeah. And I would also say be looking out for people with various trade skills and medical backgrounds and everything in the process, and connecting with them. And like you said, you know, you don't have to necessarily talk with them about what's coming down the pike here, even though most people should be seeing that right now. But at least, you know, you've developed this connection and this friendship. And so when that time comes, you know, it's everyone's going to want to help each other out. So
that's good
advice. Wow, what a power-packed hour. That was some fantastic information, Stefan. It's great stuff. And that this is, you know, I would recommend people go to chinastrategies.com. That's chinastrategies.com/survival library. And you can find the whole entire survival library. I've been kind of going through here. I had it on the screen here while we were talking about it. I tell you, you know, it'd probably be easier to cite what you didn't include in there than what you did include, for crying out loud. I mean, it's power packed. Tell us a little bit about that really quick before we go. It looks like you've got shelter team, looks like you got the medical team, and that's, they can just go right to your website and they can download that whole thing and put it right on their computer and have it for their group.
See, the benefit of doing this is that it's on PDF, and then I recommend people transfer to a flash drive. Now, you can use that flash drive with like a Kindle reader or with your cell phone, and there are ways to recharge the batteries for your cell phone. So even if the electricity goes down, you know, get one of those little solar battery chargers, right? So that at least you can recharge your cell phone or your iPad or your Kindle reader. And then you've got all these books, 320 books, covers everything you could possibly think of: communications, weapons, hunting, fishing, gardening, farming. And you can read it because no internet, no TV. You're going to have a lot of time on your hands to read. And you can always access all this information on your flash drive. And you only have to recharge, you know, 3 AA batteries. That's all you got to do. And you've got a wealth of knowledge, and that knowledge will save your life.
Stefan Verstappen, we so much appreciate you joining us here today on the broadcast on the Solution Series update here with really some great survival tips. Folks, tell your friends about the Solution Series. They can go to Solari.com or Corey'sDigs.com and sign up for the Solution Series. There's going to be 24 Solution Series episodes per year, and we're always going to have great guests like Stefan Verstappen here on the broadcast. Stefan, we so much appreciate you being here today. Corey, always great to be with you again, dear. And anything that you want to say in closing before we go ahead and close out the video?
I just really appreciate Stefan coming on and talking with us. And I encourage, you know, I with my father, we did a consult with Stefan for actually, we went quite a bit over, imagine that. So it was very, very helpful. I got a great amount of tips that I hadn't thought of before. And then also you do a whole community building program as well on there. So I recommend people check all of that out. And thank you so much for being here with us.
You're very welcome, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you on today, folks. And that's just the end of the broadcast for our guest, Stefan Verstappen, and my co-host, Corey Lynn. I'm your host, James White. And check out the Solution Series once again at Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. Until next time, this is James White for the Solution Series. Saying bye now.